The latter, seeing the Athenians applauding loudly in the theater at what is shameful, if it does not seem so to those who practice it, at once countered it. The shameful is shameful, whether it seems so or not. And Cleanthes, on the subject of wealth, rewrote, to give one's body to friends, and should it fall into sickness, to save it by expense, thus, to give one's body to whores, and should it fall into sickness, to ruin it by expense. And Zeno, correcting the line of Sophocles, whoever goes to a tyrant's court is his slave, even though he came there free, rewrote it as he is not a slave if he came there free, thereby making free signify the fearless, high-minded, and unhumbled man. What, then, prevents us too from urging the young toward what is better by such rephrasings, making use of what is said in some such fashion as this? This is what men should envy, that the bow of one's care fall upon what one wishes. No, rather, that the bow of one's care fall upon what is advantageous. For to want and to obtain what one ought not is pitiable and not to be envied. And, not upon every good thing did Atreus beget you, Agamemnon, you must both rejoice and grieve. No, by Zeus, we shall say instead, you must rejoice and not grieve when you obtain what is moderate, for not upon every good thing did Atreus beget you, Agamemnon. Alas, this by now is a God-sent evil among men, when one knows the good but does not act on it. It is indeed bestial, irrational, and pitiable for a man who knows the better course to be led by the worse through lack of self-control and softness. It is the speaker's character that persuades, not his argument. Rather, character and argument, or character working through argument, just as a rider works through the bit and a helmsman through the rudder, virtue possessing no instrument so humane and so akin to itself as reason. Does it incline more to the female than to the male? Wherever beauty is present, it is impartial. It would have been better to say, wherever self-control is present, it is impartial, truly so, and evenly balanced. Whereas the man swayed this way and that by pleasure and by youthful bloom is left-handed and unsteady. Fear of the divine belongs to the self-controlled among mortals. And yet not at all, rather, confidence in the divine belongs to the self-controlled among mortals, while fear belongs to the senseless, the foolish, and the thankless, because they regard with suspicion, as something harmful, the very power and source of every good, and are afraid of it. Such, then, is the kind of correction in question. But the further use one may make of such sayings was rightly pointed out by Chrysippus, that one must transfer and carry over their usefulness to things of the same kind. For Hesiod, when he says, not even an ox would perish, were it not for a bad neighbor, says the same, in effect, about a dog and about a donkey, and about everything else alike that is capable of perishing. And again, when Euripides says, who is a slave if he takes no thought of death? One must understand that he has said the same thing about pain and about disease. For just as physicians, having learned the power of a drug suited to one disease, transfer it and apply it to everything similar, so too a saying capable of being made common and put to public use ought not to be left tied narrowly to one single matter, but should be set in motion toward everything of the same kind. And the young should be trained to perceive this commonality and to transfer swiftly what applies, practicing and exercising their quickness of perception on many examples, so that when Menander says, blessed is the man who has both substance and sense, they may suppose this said also of reputation, of leadership, and of the power of eloquence. And likewise the rebuke addressed to Achilles, sitting among the maidens on Syros, by Odysseus. But you, who quench the bright light of your line, do you card wool, born as you are of the noblest of the Greeks? They should suppose is meant also for the prodigal, and for the shamefully greedy man, and for the careless and uneducated man. You drink, born of the noblest of the Greeks, or you gamble at dice, or bet on quails, or keep a shop, or lend at usury, thinking nothing great and nothing worthy of your noble birth. Do not say wealth. I do not marvel at a possession which even the basest man readily acquires. Then do not say reputation either, nor bodily beauty, nor a general's cloak, nor a priest's crown, things which we see even the basest men obtaining. For cowardice bears shameful children, and yes, by Zeus, so do licentiousness, superstition and envy, and all the other diseases of the soul besides. And Homer has spoken most aptly in Paris, best in looks, and Hector, best in looks. For he shows this to be worthy of censure and reproach, in one who has nothing better to offer than good looks. This too must be applied to similar cases, checking those who think highly of themselves over things worth nothing, and teaching the young to regard as an insult and a reproach, best at making money, and best at dining, and best among slaves or pack animals. And by Zeus, even the bare word best said straightway on its own, for one ought to pursue eminence starting from noble things, being first among the first and great among the greatest. Whereas a reputation drawn from small and trivial things is inglorious and unworthy of ambition. This is brought home to us at once by the example one finds in surveying the terms of censure and of praise, above all in Homer's poems. For it becomes strikingly clear from them that bodily and fortuitous advantages are not to be reckoned worthy of great concern. For in the first place, in their greetings and forms of address, they do not call men handsome or rich or strong, but use such honorific epithets as Zeus-born son of Laertes, resourceful Odysseus, and Hector, son of Priam, equal to Zeus in counsel, and Achilles, son of Peleus, great glory of the Achaeans, and noble son of Menoetius, dear to my heart. But then, when they revile one another, they touch on nothing bodily at all, but direct their censures at faults. Heavy with wine, with the eyes of a dog and the heart of a deer, and wretched in strife, ill-counseled fool, and Idomeneus, why do you boast so before your time? It does not become you to play the braggart, and wretched in speech, blustering oaf, and finally their sights is reviled by Odysseus not as lame or bald or hunchbacked, but as confused of speech. Whereas Hephaestus, though lame, is addressed by his own mother in affection, on account of that very lameness, as rise up, my crook-footed child. Thus Homer mocks those who feel shame over lameness or blindness, holding that what is not disgraceful should not be blamed, and that what comes about not through our own fault, but by chance is not disgraceful either. Two great benefits, then, accrue to those carefully trained to listen to poetry in this way. The one tending toward moderation, not to reproach anyone harshly and thoughtlessly for his fortune, the other tending toward greatness of spirit, that when they themselves meet with reversals of fortune, they not be humbled or disturbed, but bear mockery, abuse, and ridicule with equanimity, keeping especially ready at hand the saying of Philemon, "Nothing is sweeter, nor more in tune, than to be able to bear being reviled." But if someone appears actually to need correction, one should take hold of his faults and his passions, just as the tragic Adrastus did when Alcmaeon said to him, "You are born kin to a murderous woman," and he replied, "But you, with your own hand, killed the mother who bore you." For just as those who beat clothing do not touch the body within, so those who reproach certain misfortunes or low birth are directing their blows at what is external, emptily and thoughtlessly, without touching the soul or the things that truly stand in need of correction and of biting reproof. And just as before, against base and harmful poetry, we set in array the sayings and maxims of famous statesmen, and thereby seem to undermine and check belief in the poets, so too, whatever we find among them that is fine and useful, we ought to nurture and strengthen with the demonstrations and testimonies of the philosophers, crediting the discovery to those philosophers. For this is both just and beneficial, since belief gains in strength and authority when what is said on the stage, sung to the lyre, and rehearsed in school agrees with the doctrines of Pythagoras and of Plato, and when the precepts of Chilon and of Bias lead to the same conclusions as those childhood readings. Hence one must point out, and not merely in passing, that, my child, deeds of war are not given to you. Rather, you must pursue the lovely deeds of marriage, is no different from Zeus is jealous of you, if you fight with a better man. It carries the very same thought. And fools, who do not know how much more the half is than the whole, is the same as an evil counsel is worst for the one who counseled it. This is identical with Plato's doctrines in the Gorgias and the Republic, concerning the claim that doing wrong is worse than suffering wrong, and that to do evil is more harmful than to suffer it. One must add to this, too, the confident line of Aeschylus, "Toil has no long duration at its peak," for this is the very thing constantly repeated and admired as coming from Epicurus, namely that great pains bring a swift end, while long-lasting ones carry no great weight. Of these two sayings, Aeschylus stated the one plainly, while the other lies close beside what he said. For if the toil that is great and intense does not last, then what does last is not great, nor hard to endure. And as for the words of Thespis, these, You see that Zeus is foremost among the gods in this, that he practices no falsehood, no boasting, and no foolish laughter. How does this differ from the divine is set far apart from pleasure and pain, as Plato used to say? And let us affirm that virtue holds a glory to be trusted, but wealth keeps company even with cowards, a saying of Bacchylides, and again, similarly, from Euripides. And I count nothing more venerable than self-control, since it is always found among the good. And you strive to honor wealth, and think that by it you will achieve virtue. Yet, for all your noble company, you will sit there unblessed. Is this not a demonstration of what the philosophers say about wealth and about external goods, namely that apart from virtue, they are useless and unprofitable even to those who possess them? For to connect and align these lines so closely with philosophical doctrines draws the poems out of the realm of myth and of the theatrical mask, and lends weight to them as things usefully said. Moreover, it opens up in advance and sets in motion beforehand the young person's soul toward the arguments of philosophy. For he then comes to those arguments not wholly untasted of them, nor unaccustomed to hearing them, nor uncritically full only of what he has always heard from his mother and his nurse, and, by Zeus, from his father and his tutor, people who count the rich blessed and honor them, while shuddering at death and at toil, who regard virtue as nothing to be envied, and who think nothing matters apart from money and reputation. When such young people hear the philosophers saying the opposite of all this, at first bewilderment, confusion, and astonishment seize them, and they neither accept it nor endure it. Unless, as though about to see the sun after long being in darkness, they have first grown accustomed, in a kind of dim, blended light, truth mixed with myth, a gentle radiance, to look steadily at such things without discomfort and without turning away. For having already heard it in poetry, and having already read it, that one should mourn for the one who is born, considering into how many evils he is coming, but should send off the dead man, who has ceased from his toils, rejoicing and with words of good omen from the house. And for what more, mortals, do we need than these two things only, the fruit of Demeter and a draught of water? And O tyranny, dear to barbarian men! And the prosperity of mortals. Those who are troubled least by such things become less disturbed and less resentful when they hear from the philosophers that death is nothing to us, and that the wealth that nature requires has its limits, and that happiness and blessedness lie not in abundance of money, nor in bulk of possessions, nor in any offices or positions of power, but in freedom from pain, in gentleness of the passions, and in a disposition of soul in accordance with. That is defined according to nature. For these reasons, then, and because of everything said before, the young man needs good guidance in his reading, so that, rather than being prejudiced beforehand, he may instead be prepared in advance, made well-disposed, friendly, and akin to philosophy by poetry, and so sent forward toward it.